Chapter 47. An Environmentalist is Executed. The Seychelles story is a dramatic case of an attempted assassination of a head of state, particularly remarkable because it involved a massive force of mercenaries and resulted in the hijacking of a commercial airliner. It also underscores the fact that such tactics generally are undertaken only when EHMs have failed. In Africa, the EHM failures are many. Therefore, assassinations have played a major role in the politics of that continent. Although most have been conducted in secret, some have taken the guise of legal executions. Perhaps the most famous in this category is that of Ken Saro-Wiwa. Saro-Wiwa was a Nigerian environmentalist and member of the Ogoni tribe who led the movement against the exploitation of his homeland by oil companies. In 1994, he was interviewed by Amy Goodman on Pacifica radio station WBAI, New York. Ken Saro-Wiwa said, quote, "Shell Oil Company decided they should keep an eye on me and watch wherever I go to. Follow me constantly to ensure that I do not embarrass Shell. So as far as I'm concerned, I'm a marked man. Early this year, on the 2nd of January to be precise, I was placed under house arrest with my entire family for 3 days. In order to stop a planned protest against Shell, 300,000 Ogoni people were going to move to protest the devastation of the environment by Shell and the other multinational oil companies. All they did was simply send the military authorities to my house. They disconnected my telephones, confiscated the handsets, and I was held for 3 days without food." Unquote. Ken Saro-Wiwa was arrested again later that year and tried by the government of Sani Abacha, a pro-corporatocracy dictator, in what many observers described as a kangaroo court. On November 10, 1995, Ken Saro-Wiwa and 8 of his fellow environmentalists were hanged. The executed leader's son, Ken Wiwa, appeared on Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! In 2005. Ken Wiwa said, quote, "My father didn't bear grudges. It's not in the nature of my family or my community to bear grudges. We believe that Shell was part of the problem and must be part of the solution. We still feel that some kind of dignity and a commitment to social justice, that the situation could still be salvaged. But it's been almost 10 years since my father was executed. Not a single member of the Nigerian military, which invaded Ogoni, conducted extrajudicial murders, raped young girls, women, all in the name of trying to suppress the protest of our organization so that oil could resume. Not one member of the military has been arrested." Unquote. Assassinations, whether carried out by jackals like Jack Corbin or in the courts of dictatorial governments, have an enormous negative impact on social and environmental movements. The fear of arrest, torture, and death, and its effect on families and communities, has convinced many reformers to abandon their campaigns. That fact is certainly not lost on the corporatocracy. Today, as I write this sentence, Jack and other members of the Seychelles team are plying their trade in Iraq. Under the pretense of defending democracy, they conduct operations designed to protect the facilities of U.S. corporations that are reaping windfall profits. Similar to EHMs, they work for private firms hired by the State Department, Pentagon, or through one of the accounts hidden among the blacklists of the intelligence community. According to their contracts, they provide security services and management consulting. The sad story of the displaced people of Diego Garcia continues. In the last years of the 20th century, the exiled islanders launched a campaign to return to their homes, claiming physical and emotional suffering for the 30 years of poverty, dispossession, and exile. They sought compensation as well as titles to their lands. One of their barristers, Sir Sidney Kentridge QC, referred to the original deal as, quote, "a very sad and by no means creditable episode in British history." Unquote. The BBC decried it as a scandal that, quote, "involves bribes from the United States, racism among senior civil servants, and the UK government deceiving Parliament and the United Nations." Unquote. In 2000, a London court, quote, ruled that the deportation was illegal. But the government does not want the islanders back on Diego Garcia, which could be used as a base for a U.S. attack on Iraq. Unquote. The stories of the attempted coup in Seychelles and the plundering of Diego Garcia are extremely disturbing, especially considering that they were carried out under the pretext of defending democracy. Tragic as they were, however, they pale beside the crimes that were perpetrated throughout so much of the rest of the continent, and continue today. Chapter 48. The Least Understood Continent. Jack was one of many jackals in EHMs I spent time with following the publication of my book Confessions. Given the abuses carried out for the corporatocracy on every continent, I often wondered why my conversations with them turned so frequently to Africa. The men and women who have been so intimately involved in shaping the last four decades of world history seem absorbed by activities on that continent. The United States' role in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba in the Congo, our support of dictators like Jonas Savimbi in Angola, Mobutu Sese Seko and Laurent Kabila in the Congo, Abacha and Olusegun Obasanjo in Nigeria, and Samuel Doe in Liberia, as well as recent atrocities in Rwanda, the Sudan, and Liberia. Some were distressed by the failure of the Clinton administration's African Renaissance, which most agreed was a not-so-subtle ploy to support one ruthless strongman after another. They talked at length about more recent attempts to forgive debt in many countries, of the Bush administration's determination to craft this seemingly generous act into the latest and most subtle EHM trick to promote the rule of the corporatocracy. They came to me after reading my book because they too had been sucked in, taught at business and law schools that progress demands approaches that sometimes seem inconsistent with democracy, but are required as a means to the end, and because they were skilled warriors in need of employment. They had bought the company line, were either lulled into believing it or accepted that it served their best interests or both. And now, like me, they were haunted, racked with guilt. They wanted to talk, to confess, to share their stories with a sympathetic listener, and perhaps to do something to redeem themselves. These men and women knew only too well that the people of the United States have been deceived, and that they themselves were the instruments of deception. Despite political rhetoric, the African continent is poorer today than it was when I lived in Alexandria, Jack headed for Rhodesia, and many of the others were starting their careers 30 years ago. 43 of the 53 African nations suffer from chronic hunger and low income levels. Famine and drought periodically plague large areas. Mineral resources are exploited by foreign industries that take advantage of lax regulations and corrupt officials to avoid investing their profits locally, thus perpetuating weak economies and incompetent governments. People are driven to violence, ethnic conflict, and civil war. 3 million children die each year from hunger and hunger-related diseases. The average life expectancy for the continent is 46. Approximately that of the United States in 1900. And 45% of the population is under the age of 15, but will never realize their productive potentials because of hunger, cholera, yellow fever, malaria, tuberculosis, polio, HIV/AIDS, and war. Nearly 30 million Africans suffer from HIV, and millions of children have been orphaned by AIDS. The problems that confront Africa are by no means new. Their roots stretch back to the colonialism that began with the Age of Exploration and continued through the first half of the 20th century. I've got no idea where I come from. James, a man holding a middle management position at the World Bank, told me in 2005, summing up a dilemma that he suggested symbolizes the plight of the entire continent. My great-great-grandparents were dragged out of their homes and brought here as slaves. Unlike the Latinos, Asians, and Middle Easterners living in the States, I find it hard to relate to my own background. I don't even know what language my forefathers spoke. The slave trade was arguably the most horrific and destructive act by men against men in a long history of human brutality. Add to it the ruthless repression of indigenous cultures, the influence of literature, art, and film that frequently portrayed the native peoples as less than human savages, the diversity of the colonial powers that swarmed Africa, and the outright attempts to divide, conquer, and exploit, and it becomes tempting to conclude that Africa is the most thoroughly abused and the least understood region on the planet today. Countries in Asia, Latin America, and the Middle East are interwoven with common threads. Africa is a tangled knot. Its history, geography, cultures, religions, politics, crops, and natural resources are discordant. This engenders a sense of separateness, even isolation, that in turn facilitates exploitation from within as well as from the outside. In many countries, the colonial masters of the past, the European elites, have simply been replaced by native African elites. They follow patterns established by their predecessors and openly collaborate with foreign executives who wantonly ravage the land and its people. While identifying historical trends may help define future options, faulting past errors for current inequities merely postpones attempts at reaching solutions. The EHM and Jackal men and women I met with know beyond any doubt that responsibility for the current endemic poverty lies at the feet of the post-World War II empire builders. They also understand the importance of talking and writing about Africa. They accept that we now must take on the tasks of spreading the word and insisting on change. Since Africa is the least understood continent, it is also the one most easily ignored and therefore vulnerable to plunder. A majority of participants at my speaking engagements raise their hands when I ask if they know something about Bolivia, Venezuela, Vietnam, Indonesia, or any country I name in the Middle East. But I see few hands when I ask about Angola, Gabon, or Nigeria. This is not because the African countries are unimportant to us. Nigeria is the fifth largest supplier of U.S. oil, Angola is sixth, and Gabon 10th. Nigeria has the 9th largest population in the world, just before Japan, 10th, and Mexico, 11th. U.S. ignorance about Africa is ingrained in our educational systems, including the mainstream media. It is calculated, because we do not know. We do not care. Because we do not care, these countries are open territory for mistreatment, even more than those that fall within our radar. We have read about Bolivia, so it takes an effort to convince us that Evo Morales is a radical cocaine-growing socialist instead of the nationalistic farmer Bolivians overwhelmingly voted into office. However, no one has to convince us of anything about African leaders. They are essentially invisible to us, non-persons, like the Diego Garcia Islanders. Invisible people can be driven off their lands, imprisoned, and executed. "I'm ashamed to be an American whenever I travel to Africa," James confessed. "Africans ask if my people in the States know about them. Did we hear about the millions of children who have died in the wars, the orphans and amputees, the locust invasion, the floods and droughts? I can't bear to admit the truth." "We don't know. Most Americans simply don't care, even African Americans." He rubbed his hands over his eyes. "And you know what's one of the worst aspects of this? The agencies that are supposed to be the good guys are part of the game. I'm not just talking about the World Bank either. The deception includes some of the nonprofits, the NGOs." Chapter 49. NGOs, a stake in keeping Africa poor. "Are we being used?" Jenny Williams asked, referring to her work with NGOs in Africa. "Are the concepts of aid and development simply tools in the arsenal of the West, wielded not for the sake of charity, but for the sake of control?" I had become acquainted with Jenny during the editing of my book Confessions. An intern at Barrett Kohler, my hardcover publisher, she offered brilliant insights, and then headed off to travel across Africa and work for a nonprofit that runs both emergency relief and development projects in Uganda and Sudan. "I was fed up with the hypocrisy of the West and tired of being an armchair critic," she said. "I wanted to actually get on the ground and do something, see for myself what was happening with all that aid money." I found her perspective especially interesting because, growing up in San Diego, graduating from UC Berkeley in 2004, she had been subjected all her life to the media hype that promotes habituated consumerism and the idea that foreign aid helps the poor. She, like my daughter Jessica, represents the generation that will lead us into the future. The email she sent from Uganda in September 2006 continued. The signs of westernization in Africa are constant and clear. Coca-Cola, plastered across kiosks in drought-ridden northern Kenya, the proliferation of American rap and hip-hop paraphernalia among impoverished African youth, people drinking imported instant coffee instead of locally grown beans because it tastes better, when in fact it's because their own products are more expensive due to corporatocracy-imposed tariffs and taxes. I'm sure corporations would have seen Africa as ripe for consuming regardless, but NGOs are part of the machine that sustains westernization. From leadership styles to expat salaries, NGOs enforce Western cultural, social, and economic standards that create a gap between aid workers and the people they're trying to serve, a gap that Africans are constantly striving to narrow by emulating the foreigners. Western values overturn cultural beliefs and send local economic systems into upheaval. Another dilemma. In northern Uganda, a region ravaged by 20 years of rebel warfare that has left thousands of people killed and nearly 2 million displaced, NGOs have been accused of prolonging the conflict simply by being there. As long as the situation is considered an emergency, donors will continue funding activities and NGOs will continue flocking to the scene to care for people living in horrifying conditions in squalid camps. One Ugandan radio station joked that there are more NGOs than bodabodas, motorcycle taxis that crowd the streets of every city. There's no question that the Ugandans living in these camps, some for 10 years or more, would be dying in even greater numbers without the provision of boreholes for wells, sanitation, educational facilities, and food relief by NGOs. But because of the NGO presence, both the Ugandan government and the West have been able to shirk responsibility for ending the fighting that has stalled the development of an entire region. The peace talks happening now in the summer of 2006 are long overdue. We're like a fig leaf that Western governments hide behind when they don't have or want a diplomatic or political solution, one co-worker told me. In any conflict, any crisis, who goes in first? Aid organizations, of course. So the West can say, look, we're doing something, even if they don't really want to solve the real problems in the end. Ultimately, it's not just that the West is apathetic or has no motivation to solve conflicts. It's that the West has a real stake in keeping Africa poor. People in Western countries have sincere feelings of charity, and they have faith that aid works. But Western governments and multinational corporations reap enormous benefits from the continued instability and destitution of African countries. The successful manipulation of cheap labor and agricultural products, smuggled resources and arms trading, relies on corrupt politicians, prolonged warfare, and an underdeveloped civil society that lacks the capacity to stand up for its rights. If there were peace and transparency in the Congo, it would be much more difficult, if not impossible, for foreign corporations to exploit the mineral resources. If there were no rebel groups or tribal conflicts, there would be no market for small arms. Not all causes of poverty or violence are directly linked to Western motives. Corruption among African leaders and latent tribal tensions play a big role in poor governance and the disunity of African people. But I believe if the West truly wanted to see a stable, developed Africa, the continent would be well on its way. Instead, the situation is worse after decades of Western involvement and billions of dollars of aid money. I fully believe that most aid workers are honest, hard-working people who want to help vulnerable and marginalized people in developing countries. We are up against a system that is difficult to comprehend and still harder to fight. Yet that is exactly the point. We must change this system. Jenny is not alone in her commitment to understanding the situation and working to change it. University students and recent graduates around the United States seem to understand the problems confronting their generation better than their parents did. When they travel abroad, they often shun the old destinations, Paris, Rome, Athens, and head instead for Africa, Asia, and Latin America. They attend rallies and conferences, like the World Social Forums, and they mix with the local people. They play music, dance, drink beer, and fall in love. But above all, they discuss world politics, compare ideas, and plan. Something that even the most environmentally and socially aware members of that generation might not realize, however, is that another widely accepted trait of their generation, dependence on cellular and computer technology, is destroying the lives of millions of people.